طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on Truth and Justice Radio. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this week with words out of Gaza, where that imprisoned population just celebrated the one-year anniversary of the Great March of Return. It was highly recognized throughout the international community, which is why the Israeli Hasbara felt compelled to push back. Their response was critiqued by one of Gaza's most authentic voices, that of Professor Haider Eid, in the following statement that he wrote in Mondawise. Professor Haider Eid writes, and I quote, "With the first anniversary of the Great March of Return, some disturbing questions have risen. Similar questions were raised in 2009, 2012, and 2014. In fact, this has been happening since 1948. It is becoming even more disturbing now to hear the same arguments being made by some of us who have internalized their subjugation by repeating the Israeli Hasbara regarding our responsibility for our own death at the fence of the Gaza concentration camp. Victims blaming victims for their own death at the hands of Israeli snipers stationed on the other side of the eastern fence. Golda Meir, who unashamedly said that she would never forgive Palestinians for making Israeli soldiers kill them, would have been so delighted. To Israel's delight, we are being told by certain sectors that Hamas is behind the Great March of Return, that Hamas has been inciting people who happen to be ignorant and passive to demonstrate at the fence for one reason only, gaining more political power at the expense of Palestinian rights. Forget that almost all political organizations are represented on the Supreme High Committee of the March, that the Great March of Return is in itself a civil society initiative. And forget about the fact that the majority of the demonstrators, including the writer of this piece, are not supporters of Hamas, that the main demand of the march is the implementation of the UN Resolution 194, which stipulates the right of return for all Palestinian refugees who happen to constitute more than 75% of the Palestinians of Gaza. And forget that the march is a form of nonviolent civil resistance that is part and parcel of the tradition of Palestinian anti-colonial struggle, not unlike the South African anti-apartheid and American civil rights fights for justice. This is not to say that Hamas, being an opportunistic right-wing organization, is not trying to hijack what it considers the spoils of the Great March of Return. Resistance in all its forms, violent and otherwise, is considered by some people futile. Typically, the defeatist Palestinian camp simply uses the numbers of martyrs and disabled to condemn the Great March of Return. The question now being raised by some Palestinian intellectuals and political forces after the unexpected brutality of the Israeli military, is it worth it? The Great March of Return, like the BDS movement, has created a political upheaval that has not only put an end to the fiction of the two-state solution and brought back liberation rather than independence on the agenda. It has also contributed to, if not expedited, a new consciousness, one that seeks a link between all forms of popular resistance and the end of the fictional, racist, two-state solution, and hence the necessity for a new political vision based on a complete break from the Oslo ideology and its defeatist logic. Palestinians, whether in Gaza or in the diaspora or in Israel, cannot forget the blood of those children, men and women, who sacrificed their lives at the fence of the concentration camp so that all Palestinians could live and continue to resist, not surrender. The message from the Eastern Fence is very clear. There can be no going back to fake solutions and negotiations. It's time for a final push to real freedom, justice, and equality. And that's the end of the quote. That was a statement written by Professor Haider Eid of Al-Quds University in Gaza. And now on to our feature presentation, which is a recorded forum held during Apartheid Week at Harvard University. It features Cornel West, Dimi Khalidi, Mark Lamont. It begins with introductions by the moderator.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Let's try again.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Yeah, let's get that out there. So I'm going to introduce the panelists through my personal connections with them. You can read their bios online. The three panelists are very well-known people, and the bios are on Facebook, so you can find it. Okay? I'm going to start with Dr. West. I think it shows how much I love and adore Dr. West. Professor
right
West used to visit our class. We used to teach a class 20-some years ago at the School of Education called Education for Social and Political Change. It was taught by a professor, Aileen de los Reyes, a Boricua, one of those that you really, really like. And it was elective. Nobody had to take the course, and every semester we would have 120 students sign up for our course. And Dr. West was our favorite part of the whole semester. He would always come and visit and talk to the class. And since then, I've been following his work, not like stalking or anything, just like really following his work. And we meet again in 2014 in Ferguson. There was no surprise in there, because that's what Dr. West embodies. He is the person who studies and teaches at Ivy League universities, and he is the person who shows up at Ferguson and walks the streets and stays up at night with the young people in the streets and gets arrested. Dr. West does the whole round. He is, for me, the embodiment of what Gramsci called the organic intellectual. The first time I met Mark Lamont Hill was on Facebook. He didn't meet me, but I did. And I started seeing these posts. I mean, the first thing that I saw was pictures from Jerusalem. I grew up in Jerusalem, and I'm not allowed to enter it. And here's somebody who's not only capturing Jerusalem in pictures beautifully and in ways that, as a Palestinian from Jerusalem, like, yeah, this is my Jerusalem. But also the comments, the questions, and turns out he speaks Arabic as well. And the focus on that part, that aspect of Palestinian life that we haven't necessarily talked about. Interviews with black Palestinians, particularly about their blackness. Growing up in Palestine, under colonial rule and settler colonialism, you get so caught up with all those big systems of oppression, you don't always take the time to look around you and ask about all these other layers of oppression. And then I come to the US, And I start understanding racism, and I start wondering how we are dealing with that in our own society in Palestine. And Mark becomes one of the people that I feel takes up that issue and does an amazing job with it. He has a film coming up soon. Keep your ears open. You'll tell us about it.
Yes.
I just met Dima tonight, but I've heard of Palestine Legal for years. So as Palestinians go through our daily lives, every minute, every step, there's something that's happening to us, and we all tell each other, call Palestine Legal.
Yes.
It's our go-to. We get the answers from it, and then those of us who have learned how to maneuver certain situations and how to deal with certain circumstances from Palestine Legal, we're spreading the knowledge around. We're not only getting legal defense, we're also learning how to defend ourselves, which questions to ask, and when we have the right to say no. We're putting our foot down here. You don't get to do this. We're going to fight it. And Palestine Legal has provided a much-needed place for Palestinians and others to turn to and ask questions and get support and educate ourselves and our communities. So help me welcome in Dima. It's a bit intimidating to be sitting on a panel with these amazing people. So I don't think I have much to say now. I'm going to hand the mic to Dr. West so you can start us off this evening, please.
Well, let me say that I am profoundly blessed to be here once again. And each and every year they have a Black Solidarity Day, I plan to be here. Is just trying to be morally consistent, to have some sense of integrity, and to fundamentally acknowledge the way in which a precious Palestinian baby has exactly the same value as a precious Jewish baby in Tel Aviv, or a precious white baby in Boston, or a brown baby in the south side of Chicago, or a red baby in Wisconsin, or a yellow baby in Japan. That sounds so simple, but it has subversive consequences when you look at the ways in which for so long it's been taboo to publicly acknowledge the rich humanity of Palestinian brothers and sisters and what kinds of structures of domination they have to live under and the ways in which those structures of domination are tied to the American empire. So there is a crucial moral, and as a revolutionary Christian, I'd say a spiritual commitment. And why is that very important? Well, it's very important because we've got so many of our precious liberals and centrists who are just scared. They're intimidated. They're so full of fear to acknowledge the rich humanity of Palestinians and actually bring critique to bear on the vicious Israeli occupation and come to terms with the Veritas. And that's what we're here for. Veritas. The truth of the history, past and present, of the Middle East and the relation between Israelis and Palestinians. And by truth, in part, I mean what Herbert Marcuse meant when he said the condition of truth is to allow suffering to speak. Now, I was blessed, but 37 years ago, to first have a teach-in at Columbia University with the one and only, the greatest public intellectual of the latter part of the 20th century in the American Empire. His name was Edward Said. Let us never, ever, ever forget the rich intellectual, political, and moral legacy of Edward Said. 1982, the invasion of Lebanon. We had teaching there at Columbia, and I had promised him, and I intend to be faithful unto death, that I would raise my voice no matter what the cost in terms of keeping track of the humanity of Palestinians. And that at the moral level, I think it's incumbent upon each and every one of us to spread the news to fellow citizens that we ought to respond to the vicious Israeli occupation of precious Palestinians in exactly the same way we would if there were a vicious Palestinian occupation of Jews. So that if there are 551 precious Palestinian babies killed in 51 days and no one can muster a public voice to acknowledge it, it's very clear that there's a moral deficit when it comes to the humanity of Palestinians. And the aim is to shatter that and to be able to sit here with my dear sister Dima and my dear sister Hussein, what a blessing to see you again. But Brother Mark Lamont Hill, I think, is actually taking it to a whole new level. He's in the legacy of Paul Robeson and W. Du Bois Du Bois and others because he's had to pay such a major cost in raising his voice on the international stage.
Yes.
On the international stage. On that rich legacy, because he and I come from a people who have been hated, terrorized, stigmatized for 400 years, but in the name of Ella Baker, in the name of Fannie Lou Hamer, in the name of Harriet Tubman, in the name of Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, Curtis Mayfield, Cecil Nina Simone, we're going to raise the truth to allow the suffering to speak. Now, we can have disagreement. This is very important. We jazz-like. We're not looking for some military orchestra where everybody's on the same beat. No. We have some disagreements in terms of how we go about understanding, maybe. But when it comes to three fundamental, non-negotiable issues in regard to Palestinian brothers and sisters, one is that we must know the truth of 1948. We must reject on moral grounds vicious occupation. I say the same thing about Kashmir. I say the same thing about Tibet. I say the same thing about Western Sub-Sahara of Morocco and so forth and so on. And then third, we must never, ever, as you can imagine, succumb to any kind of anti-Jewish sensibility, anti-Jewish hatred, or anti-Jewish orientation. And I don't say anti-Semitic because there's a whole lot of folk who are Semitic who are not Jewish. That the humanity of our precious Jewish brothers and sisters is as precious as anybody else, but that must never, ever, ever be an excuse to not raise your voice, to be a justification of your fear, or I would say your cowardliness.
Yes.
And so don't let anybody tell you that because you have fallen in love with Palestinians, that somehow you hate Jewish brothers and sisters. Because I believe in multiple love. Try to love all of them, especially when they're poor and working class, so that if I'm morally consistent, I'm freed up to be able to tell the truth about what has been going on since 1948, tell the truth of what's going on now, and the ways in which what this whole week is about, which has to do with apartheid-like conditions, especially in occupied territories. In some ways, worse. Inside of Israel, second-class, third-class citizenship. How do we have a conversation? We will have that conversation tonight. How blessed I am to be here, and I'm not going to say too much more because I want to hear all of your voices, and especially these magnificent voices, but I just want to say that you all honor me by including an old school brother going all the way back to the 1960s and still trying to keep my fire alive before the worms get my body.
Insisting that I go first, and I really should have done that. Yeah.
Do your thing.
Yeah.
Do your thing.
Yeah, I mean, the honor is really mine, and I just to be speaking with such morally consistent and courageous and bold leaders, I'm really honored. And I just want to thank the PSC for all the work that you've put into this. I think you all know it's been an uphill battle, one to get
funding for IAW and to have this event without a hitch. You may not know that PSC was called yesterday, and told that they would have to pay for security guards because this were apparently too controversial for Harvard. Charles Murray and his, you know, pseudoscientific racist theories aren't too controversial, but advocating for Palestinian freedom and equality is too controversial for Harvard. So we've managed to push back on that, and you know, we're all good there. But this is exactly the kind of Palestine exception to free speech that Palestine Legal deals with every day. That you have to even fight these battles to have these conversations says so much about where we are today. And, you know, I think seeing from our vantage point, having responded to over 1,200 incidents of suppression like this, you know, these even just these small obstacles to having events like this, what we see is the specific targeting of people of color who are speaking out about this. And Palestinians face one of the largest burdens, of course, but Arabs and Muslims, Black and Latinx and other indigenous allies are the ones who are most targeted by this really overwhelming and very concerted effort to undermine the movement for Palestinian rights. And there's a reason for that. You know, this is the fact is that organizing across movements has always been a threat to the status quo. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
You know, that's what's happening here. We're seeing right now, today, the movement for Palestinian rights is at a critical point. And that's because over the last 10, 20 years, we've seen this burgeoning movement in the U.S. And that's characterized by you all, youth on campuses, you know, scholars speaking out. It's in response to the complete destruction of Gaza over the last, you know, with successive wars, and the continuing expansion of settlements, the complete dehumanization of Palestinians, the occupation, et cetera, et cetera. We could go on. That has all been televised for us, and by a growing movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which has helped mobilize people to stand in solidarity with Palestinians. So the youth and the grassroots nature of this movement, as well as has really helped to create more intersectional and internationalist work. Yeah. And that's what is really critical to see about this movement, and will help us understand why there is so much backlash happening here. And it's really based on an understanding of oppression that looks at the commonalities of our oppressors, that, you know, where we can realize that the same tear gas canisters made in the U.S. are used against Black protesters in Ferguson, and they're used against Palestinian protesters in Palestine. And the same companies that have been building a wall in Palestine for decades now are trying to build a wall here on our border with Mexico. So these are not coincidences. You know, the same, both here and there, we have an institutionalized racism and discrimination that enable the supremacy of one group over another or over many others. These are commonalities in our situations, and people are seeing that, and people are speaking out and organizing. The second thing is really that, you know, I think it's important to recognize how important Black Palestinian solidarity has been over the last several years, especially. And we have to recognize that it's not new either. I mean, my family members told me stories about their meetings with Black Panther members in Algeria in the 1970s, right? This is, there are historic connections here from a deep internationalist legacy. But, you know, what we're seeing today and the kind of bold and courageous speaking that is happening by people like Mark and people like Angela and people like Cornell has really created a critical conversation in this country. And, those current manifestations of Black Palestinian solidarity have also been declared threats very clearly. Not only are we seeing surveillance and targeting of Palestinian activists. We also have the FBI calling the Black Lives Matter, the Movement for Black Lives, Black Identity extremists. But, you know, we also have the Israeli government itself, Israeli officials, saying very clearly, one in particular said, the major problem with Israel is with the young generation of the Black community. That is where Black Lives Matter starts. And so they see Michelle Alexander's piece in the New York Times as a strategic threat. They actually say this. Why? Why is that? It's because when we look at, it's that moral clarity that you all are really bringing to the fore. I think, one of the other strategies that Israel organizations have said very clearly that they're using is to neutralize this solidarity by creating fissures within the Black community and a wedge in the Black community. And I think we saw that backfired with Angela Davis, right? The Birmingham Civil Rights Institute rescinded her award because of pressure from Zionist groups. And ultimately, the Black community and the Palestinian Solidarity community rallied to her defense, and it was unacceptable. Nobody stood for it, and, they tried to get it back, but... So, clearly the immense backlash against Black intellectuals and activists who speak out on this issue is the result of how much weight this solidarity holds, how much it illuminates how clear the answer really is here when we believe in equality and justice and human dignity for everybody. So it's really no wonder, I think, that Israel and its allies here are trying to make examples of those who dare to speak out. And the reason is that they want to intimidate the rest of us.
Yeah,
they want to intimidate us into silence.
That's right.
So we know about Angela. We know about Mark's situation. We know the kind of backlash that Ilhan Omar has faced, calling out the influence of the Israel lobby. Some of the examples that we see, you don't hear about, but so many of the cases that come to us involves a disproportionate targeting of especially Black and allies of color who are specifically targeted because they are the most vulnerable, and they know that. To silence folks is how you stop the growth of this movement. I just want to give one example of the kind of solidarity that we see and that I think has become so powerful and really illustrates that we're not talking about a surface level kind of I'm down with Palestine or Black Lives Matter. But this is really the result of years and years of organizing that's happened and educating each other And that's why I think universities are such important places for this to be happening. A few years ago at Loyola University in Chicago, a few black students organized a demonstration in solidarity with the Missouri students who were protesting for racial justice issues. And they had a lot of demands for the university. A lot of people attended their demonstration. It was packed. Administrators were praising them. Everybody was, the media paid attention to it. And they went to the university and they made their demands. A few years earlier, or the year before rather, Palestinian students with Students for Justice in Palestine heard about a Birthright Israel tabling the next day. And that night they decided, you know what, why don't we go and register? We want to claim our birthright. Birthright is a program that takes Jewish youth to Israel for free because it's apparently their birthright. And so they line up at the Birthright Israel table, and they all have signs of, you know, with the names of the villages where their families came from and were expelled from. And they wanted to register. They said, oh, can I register? I'd like a free trip. I'm from, you know, Lid. I would like to claim my birthright. And right away, they were accused of bias and discrimination and anti-Semitism, etc. They were investigated. They were charged with 6 violations of the Student Code of Conduct. And they went through a little mini trial. And ultimately, they were found not responsible for everything except not registering their demonstration. Because at Loyola, you have to register several days in advance if you want to do anything. So fast forward to the next year, the black students are making their demands to the administration. And they say, and by the way, why didn't you punish us for not registering our demonstration? Because we didn't register ours, you know. So the university said, oh, okay, well then, we'll charge you with not registering your demonstration. But, you know, the black students said very clearly, this isn't fair, you know, our SJP colleagues were, you know, put through the ringer for doing the same thing. And, you know, we represented them as well, and they went through a hearing, and ultimately Loyola suspended their demonstration policy. But the point is just that, you know, these black students were also members of SJP. And the Palestinian students were also organizing this Black Lives Matter demonstration. And they were in the thick of it together, and they ultimately insisted on standing up for each other, even though they didn't have to. And so that illustrates the kind of solidarity that, you know, it's a small example, but I think it really shows the level of work that's happening. And you know. So I think the question is, how do we overcome these overwhelming attacks and the overwhelming pressure to shut up? You're all kind of young and probably thinking about your careers, and do you put everything on the line to talk about Palestine? And I think there are just a couple points here that, you know, we first have to understand what the purpose of this attack is. And as I said, it's really to silence us. It's really to make it too hard and too costly to speak up and to have a principled position on this issue. And instead of retreating, I think, you know, continuing to organize, to learn from each other, and to take courage from each other is essential. And I don't think that's really, you know, that's not maybe going to convince anybody to go out and, you know, say something right now, but this is, the fact is that our strength is not only, it's not only our strength in numbers, we have protection in numbers too. And only if we're able to stand up for each other, speak out for each other, organize with each other, can we make a difference. And it's not just making a difference in Palestine, it's making a difference here. And I think this is what's so exciting about this moment, is that people are coming together and understanding that our oppression is connected and our liberation is also connected. And that's what has to drive us forward.
Peace, everybody. This is overwhelming, man, to see this type of crowd and this type of energy for this event this week. And for the events of the entire week is really extraordinary. It speaks to the possibilities of this moment. And we are in a very strange moment.
That's right.
A very dangerous moment.
That's right.
But also a moment filled with possibility, and I'm excited by it. And the work that Palestine Legal does, the everyday grind, the everyday struggle of organizing and fighting and resisting the various legal attacks on Palestinian freedom, the ways that Palestinian liberation is undermined, not just at the social level, not just at the media level, but at the juridical level. Thinking about that every day is important, and I'm grateful for the work you do, and I'm grateful for the support that you've offered me in particular. Cornell, oh God. I hate talking after him too, but you know, we don't talk often on the phone because he's the hardest person in the world to get on the phone, other than maybe me, right? So, well, but after everything happened, y'all heard about that thing, right? You and I had a missed call from Cornell, and I was like, oh man.
It must be serious.
It must be, you know, but the call meant so much because I got a whole lot of academic friends. You know, being on TV and being in academia, there's a lot of interesting similarities around the insecurity, the competitiveness, the shallowness, there's some real interesting overlap. You know. And I gotta tell you, you know, there's a whole bunch of folk, when you pop in to answer your phone calls, that when something happened, they stop answering your phone calls. I'm calling folk. I'm thinking my phone, you know, my phone block, number block, something like that. They always answer my call. I text, ain't nothing coming back, you know. And you took the call, but more importantly, you made the call. Then you wrote a piece in The Guardian in support, and while a lot of people were running for cover, hiding, and really being prisoner to cowardice, you stood up. And you stood in solidarity, and you showed love, and you took a risk, and you've done that ever since I've known you. You've done that long before I met you. I love you. I'm grateful for you. And thank you for everything that you've done. Thank you. This moment has been so strange to me. Even just the whirlwind of the last 4 or 5 months. When I sat down at the UN and gave that speech, I could not have been prepared fully for the outcome of that speech. I wrote a 22-minute speech, and you know, I don't write speeches. You know, I got black tradition. But I said, I'm going to be careful. God's still laughing. I said, I'll be careful to make sure don't nothing happen. And I wrote 22 minutes. I was on the plane from Tel Aviv back to New York, and I wrote the speech, went to Brooklyn, changed clothes, and went straight to the UN. And I said, I want to make it clear on this day that I am going to appeal to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as my operating framework. It was the 70th anniversary of the NECBA, but it was also the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And I said, what an interesting moment that this document that emerges out of World War II as a admittedly flawed way to imagine and reimagine human rights, to have a framework that acknowledges dignity, the self-determination, the possibilities of all human beings. If we got a document like that, I can say, wait a minute, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says this, law says that. We have freedom of movement, but we got checkpoints. We're supposed to have a criminal justice system that's fair, but 99% of Palestinians are found guilty in criminal court. That's a huge question. Palestinians, they can't all be guilty.
That's right.
I mean, come on. Right? We talk about inequality in the States and we feign outrage and indignation, but we willfully support a nation state with it that just passed the nation state law and back in the summer that Netanyahu reinforced last week when he said we're not a nation of all of our citizens, we're a nation of Jewish citizens. But when you have 20% of your population who are not Jewish, what does that mean for them? What does that say about the possibilities of democracy for everybody? These are questions we gotta wrestle with. I laid the questions out. I point to the contradictions of what it means to have admissions committees where you have people who literally decide whether or not you can live in a neighborhood. We just saw it in the Galilee, about 2 months ago, about whether or not you could live in a neighborhood based on whether or not you meet the social, whether or not you can sustain the social and cultural fabric of the neighborhood. That sounds familiar, black people. So imagine being in Haifa or Akka or Lydda or anywhere, and then you walk up in the neighborhood and you try to move there as a Palestinian, what they would call an Arab Israeli. We reject that label. But imagine being a Palestinian citizen of Israel, and of course you don't meet the social and cultural criteria. Of course you don't keep the thing the same. What group comes in and keeps everything the same? Y'all walk up there smelling like that luba. Dump you on Friday. Oh, you done changed something. Or you're an Ethiopian Jew. You move there. Because they put you in the absorption center first. Russians don't. You come in there. You leave South Tel Aviv. You go to a neighborhood. And they say, wait a minute, yeah, you're Jewish. But Adam Hart, man. I'm saying, I know you learned Hebrew, but you're speaking Adam Hart, man. I'm smelling some Yodotl tips. This is going to feel right. And you can't live in the neighborhood. Suddenly, this language of apartheid becomes relevant. Not because it's like South Africa, literally. The conditions of being an apartheid nation isn't that you're just like South Africa, it's that you have a social arrangement whereby your identity or race or gender or class or some identity category becomes a predicate for increased social access or diminished social access. You get more stuff based on who you are. That's why we say it's apartheid. And in the speech, I was pretty clear, and I don't want to litigate the whole speech because that don't change nothing, but my point was, I talked very specifically about what it meant to reimagine our social arrangements such that Arab citizens or Palestinians in Israel have full citizenship rights. That we reimagine the borders to the pre-1967 war borders. And that we imagine a way home for those displaced Palestinians. Both internally displaced and displaced around the diaspora. That was the call. It wasn't a call to destroy Israel. It wasn't a call to destroy people. It wasn't a call to kill anybody. It was a call to reimagine our social arrangements. And 21 minutes and 50 seconds was all of that. And in the aftermath that day, the next day, the day after, the next month, until today, I still ain't seen nobody break apart the speech and say they disagree with the speech, or the speech was inaccurate, the speech was wrong, the speech was this, the speech was that. They focused on 6 words. I ain't gonna say them because y'all get in trouble. gigantic. Let's say from the window to the wall, right? Thank y'all. Cool. That's terrorist talk. Well, first of all, it's not. Hamas says that. If you spend any time in the region, you realize that this idea of liberating the land or engaging any kind of freedom project in the land from the river to the sea is not exclusive to Hamas. Right? It's not exclusive to 2006. It's not exclusive to their formation. It's not exclusive to any particular group. In fact, the Likud party, their platform statement in 1974 was what? Free Israel from the river to the sea. Oh. The Labor Party has said river to the sea. Every political party has said from the river to the sea. So to exclusively take Hamas and make that the person you choose, it would be like if I scream black power, you scream black power, you scream black power, and they pick the most extreme. And they say, well, the New Black Panther Party said black power, so therefore everybody who said black power must be a member of the New Black Panther Party. Do you see how that logic wouldn't hold? But it's a very specific demand. The call from the river to the sea for me was to say that we can't just focus on what happens inside of 48. We can't just focus on the 1.8 million Palestinians who live inside of Israel who got citizenship, because how many people were pushed out? How many people were expelled in 1948? How many people's villages were destroyed completely? You can't go back to Deir Yassin. Right? I mean, think about what that means. We have to think about freedom, justice, inequality, and self-determination for folk in the West Bank. Particularly at a moment where your president is
nobody in this room, right? Somebody is who, though?
Where some has taken away funds for refugees. UNRWA, the funds, gone. USAID, gone. This is the issue. And to say, what if you're still in Jordan? What if you're in Syria? What if you're here? What rights do you have? So we have to have a call from the river to the sea, in the sense that every aspect of Palestine needs to be free, of historic Palestine needs to be free. That's not a call to move Jewish people out. It's not a call to harm. Jewish people deserve self-determination, freedom, justice, equality, and safety too. Everybody deserves it. But as Cornell said, it can't be that one has a heightened value at the expense of someone else. Everybody's life is worth the same.
Right.
But because we live in a world with such rampant inequality, to affirm the legitimacy and humanity of Palestinian people is somehow seen as an affront to other folk. And that can't be the logic that governs how we do politics or how we engage each other at the interpersonal level. We got to imagine something else. I gotta say, I was a little shocked the next day when, you know, they fired me. I wasn't that shocked. I mean, it's corporate media. I've been playing with house money for about 10 years. I've been the wildest nigga on TV. So, on cable news, right?
That's right.
So, I mean, it's a pretty low bar now, don't get me wrong. But I'm just saying, in terms of left-wing, where's the left on cable news, right? So, I didn't know this would be the day I would have booked a Mumia Abu-Jamal.
That's right. Important book.
And Mumia called me like, yo, they got you, man. It's about time. I knew it was going to happen. I said, you should have told me. But that's the thing. You want borrowed time. So you can't obsess about these jobs. You can't obsess about these positions. You have to struggle for justice and freedom. And solidarity demands, justice demands, that we operate in solidarity with one another. And some black folk, this is the last thing I'll say, some black folk got mad at me, particularly some of the hashtag ADOS folk. Y'all know these folk? There's a hashtag on the internet, ADOS, a descendant of slavery. And essentially they were saying that you, American descendant of slavery, excuse me, that you squandered your platform by fighting for people who ain't you. That's what I said. I was like, you use the UN platform to advocate for Palestinians, not black folk. Why would you do that? I said, well, first, it was the International Day of Solidarity with Palestinian people, right? It wasn't open mic night at the UN. It wasn't like, you know what I'm saying? I was locked out another hour. I had a whole list of shit I could have talked about. This is what the day was. See, I had a whole list of shit I could have talked about. Prison, but this is the day. I come back from Prison Abolition Day. But second, I don't want to be part of any freedom movement that is so parochial in its thinking. I'm not talking about the ADOS movement right now, let me be clear. I'm saying any movement or any line of thinking that doesn't understand at the intellectual conceptual level, as you pointed out,
that's right,
the relationships between the two. We're getting policed in the United States, and those same policing structures and tactics and practices are happening in Israel. As a matter of fact, the trainings are happening in both countries. So it's not just conceptual, it's material. White supremacy is a global phenomenon. Capitalism is a global phenomenon.
Yes, it is. Yes.
These
yes.
are the forces. That wall building is a neoliberal project. They put on both countries. So we can't even, we don't have the luxury of looking at one versus the other. And there's a moral tradition. What do you think Malcolm was doing in 57?
Right? That's right.
What do you think Snake was doing in 67?
Yes.
Think of Ethel Meyer when she's the one who writes that Snake newsletter in the summer of 67 after the 1967 war. This is the war. Angela Davis, our dear sister. Yeah. She didn't just start doing this work when she got in the war in Alabama. This is decades of work laid down. There's a resurgence of energy. Yeah. But this is a long journey. Cornell been doing this for decades when it wasn't popular to do. Angela been doing it for decades when it wasn't popular to do. Bobby Huey popular when it wasn't. Alice Walker.
Yes.
There's a long tradition of this. We don't have the luxury of ignoring each other's pain.
Absolutely.
Of ignoring each other's social misery. Because
right.
it overlaps and it intersects. And so I was encouraged when we were in the streets of Ferguson getting tear gassed. And we got those tweets from Ramola. Because we was getting tear gassed. Don't believe the news, we was getting tear. It wasn't smoke.
Yes, it was.
It was tear gassed.
Yes.
And when Marion Barghouti sends us those texts, and other folks send us those texts saying, here's how you wash your eyes out. We in the West Bank, we just had a Gaza protest, but here's how you wash your eyes out. Here's how you make a makeshift gas mask. Here's how you run toward it. Stand close to the Israeli soldiers, because then they can't tear gas you.
Yeah.
Mm.
Those tweets, those texts, were a sign of solidarity. It was a sign that we recognize the commonality of our oppressive forces, of our oppressor, and of our possibilities for relief and for justice. We have a way out, but the way out is each other.
Yes.
The way out is each other. So let's keep fighting. Let's keep building. Let's keep organizing. Because organized people defeat organized power every single time. Let us build.
That was a forum featuring Cornell West, Dimi Khalidi, and Mark Lamont, held at Harvard University. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.